Talk 580 KMJ presents Hometown Heroes, honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes with you on Saturday afternoons here on News Talk 580 KMJ and online at kmjnow.com. If you listen to this show regularly, you know what it's all about. We want to honor our veterans, specifically those of the World War II generation. We want to honor their service and their sacrifice. We want to preserve their stories for posterity. And along the way, maybe learn a little bit, get inspired by the great legacy that this greatest generation has left to us. I'm going to get to my guest here. I want to tell you that it is going to be an abbreviated show today, Bulldog Baseball at 1:45. So let me get with it with Bud Bedford of Fresno, a Navy veteran of World War II, with a very interesting story to tell involving LCVPs. If you're a Navy man, you know what those initials mean. We're talking about Higgins boats, landing crafts, and he's going to tell us everything he knows about them. But first, let's start earlier on, Bud. Bud Bedford, my guest of Fresno. And Bud, you're a high school student in Santa Barbara. And December 7th, 1941, something happened that ended up changing your life. What do you remember about that day?
I was going to high school, and I was in ROTC, which was real popular. And when they invaded, they came on the radio, KDB, and ordered all ROTC students to come to the armory down at the school grounds. And then they took the ROTC just for a few days as coast watchers. And then, but my family, my father had a company down there, and we were involved in boats. My brothers were in the Sea Scouts. So there was a Coast Guard small base there with a cutter. So we played around with the Sea Scout boats, and we had a boat ourselves, not knowing that I was being trained without knowing it for a purpose.
And what you mean is that you had no idea what you would end up doing during the war, but right. I guess the man upstairs had an idea.
Yeah. So one day we got a notice from the president to report, and then the Navy called my home, and they were, hurry up. And so I went down, and they shipped me off to San Diego to boot camp in the Navy. And halfway through the training, well, they called some of us out and said that we were going to go to landing craft. And at that time, I understood that only volunteers went into the landing craft at that time.
And you hadn't volunteered?
No, I hadn't volunteered, and I said so real loud in the ranks, and they told me to be quiet, get my gear, and be back in 20 minutes. I was going to landing craft, which was in Coronado, right across. It's a jetty there, and they have a lot of breakers and rough water, and they had some tents there in the sand. I think the food even tasted sand. And they made us work landing those barges in the surf and out. We went through that for about a week and a half. And then all of a sudden, they loaded us up, the landing craft crews. There was 100 of us, three to a boat, 24 boats. And they shipped us off fast train up to Oregon. I realized that that train had all the crew on board but the officers. So we got up there to a shipyard, and there were welders all over it, and we had no heat or anything, but we had to spend all our hours and no time off carrying gear on board because it was just a ship. And after about 3 days of that, they finally got steam in there and we could have warm food and stuff. Other than that, they're just feeding us sandwiches for 3 days. We picked up our landing barges, and then we took off after we refueled and everything, and went down to Long Beach. We pulled in there, and that first night we pulled in, there was welders all over the ship. The next morning, it was quiet, but we looked out and got up and had chow, and there's 1,500 Marines there on the dock, and they started loading them up.
And what was that like for you as you saw those Marines boarding, knowing that you were gonna be the guy to take them into harm's way and land them on all these beaches across the Pacific.
I was homesick. I was young. I just was stunned. And I couldn't believe that I was caught in that web. We left right away, and we went up, and all of a sudden the ship, we had the feeling they didn't know what to do with us. I think they had promised MacArthur troops, and then they decided not to do it. And we pulled into Pearl Harbor, and we was only there for about 3-4 hours loading stuff up. But we were all at our general quarters. Everything was manned the whole time we was in Pearl Harbor. And that was the last time we saw an American port till after the war.
So for more than 2 years, you were on that ship, never setting foot in an American port.
Yes. Wow. And our sole purpose was invasion. At first, here we were traveling alone all the time. But I was told that our speed was such that the submarines couldn't catch up to us. But we were awful conscious of getting blown out of the water any minute. So any times why we'd stand at the rail looking out, when we'd be going along in the sea and they'd yell, "Rig the paravanes." Well, we knew what that was. They threw on either side, they had a big thing that looked like a large fish in a cable, and it was swung out over the side up at the bow on both sides, and that was out to cut the cables on mines, and the mines would float up. And here we are way at sea, and that was peculiar. And we had to shoot, they had to shoot the nipples, not the mine itself. It was hard enough that the bullet wouldn't hit it. So there'd be fellas on the ship on each side with rifles shooting at that.
Some fun target practice. Now, for our listeners' benefit, I mentioned the LCVPs, and that's what you would be involved in specifically. But all these LCVPs are carried by a bigger ship, and yours was the USS Lycoming, the APA 155. How many LCVP crews were loaded onto that one ship?
There's 24 boats, 3 men to a boat. And they're supposed to have one officer, but he never was involved in any invasion. We worked on the ship. We worked doing gun watches and mobbing the deck and that type of thing. And we worked some with the ship's crew, but not too much. We were a different breed. They gave us steel helmets. They gave us a knife for combat fighting, hand-to-hand combat, which we weren't trained to do, but we learned we had to. And then my boat was number 24. It had been replaced several times. It was on a davit, hung out over the side. There was 4 boats, 2 on either side, that hung out over the side. And so we took off, and after Pearl Harbor, we was just vague, and then we started invading. These invasions you hear about, we were there. My mother used to write me, and mail never, it would be 3 and 4 months old, and she'd say, "Well, they invaded this place, and you were there." I know. And I couldn't say anything. And they delayed our mail, which was censored because of that situation.
Do you remember the first spot where you landed troops and what that felt like, what the intensity of that was?
And we pulled into an island. We were the first in, of course, the first, and I couldn't believe it. I was in shock, and I was stunned. The GIs, when the motor mat dropped the ramp, the Japs could shoot right into the boat, and some of the troops never even got out of the boat. And the sailor up front was pushing the dead off so we could go up the ramp. I remember putting it in reverse, and that big engine screamed. And I wish I had 5 engines, and I could see the water coming in, curling around the ramp as the boat went out. Then I realized that there was a cross current, and it was starting to turn us. So I shoved it forward again and hit the beach again, and then that time I made it out. And I couldn't believe what we'd been through, but I was like a machine. I was cold. And then we unloaded the troop, and I think we lost about 5 boats in that. And then we took off. It was that big island that they invaded and had all that. They put that American flag up and all that. I found that out later. They didn't tell us much on the ship. The troops knew where we was going because they get big maps out and show them what to do on the islands and stuff.
But you guys, as just the delivery mechanism, didn't have all that information. Your job was just to get them to the beach and make it back alive, hopefully.
Well, what it is, we may be just an apprentice seaman on that ship. But when that boat's put in the water, that seaman is the boss. And he can make decisions because you can't predict what's going to happen the next minute. And he's got those 30 lives to do in it. And the boats would go off in pitch dark, and there'd be no lights on the ship. It'd be 12 on one side and 12 on the other. We'd be off the ship about 200 or 300 yards. And when we all got assembled, 12 on one side, 12 on the other, we slowly pulled up 2 at a time, 2 big cargo nets that were hanging down. And the troops came down the cargo net. You could hear them calling out their names as they came down in rows. Sometimes the cargo net would be 2 and 3 feet of it laying in the boat, and other times it'd be up. We never had any GIs fall into the water or get crushed between us and the ship. But we watched that real close. And we never did have anyone get hurt getting in. And we were loaded, and it's like a duck. It's just loaded with that front ramp. We had on the side, they had very thin armor plate, but not much. They called them plywood. They have a big engine that you learn respect because that thing had power.
Well, and I'd like to hear, and I think our listeners would, more about how those Higgins boats worked, because a lot of people have seen the images. People who are watching the Pacific right now on HBO probably see it every week with the landing craft pulling up to the beach and lowering the door and all the Marines rush out. But you've got a 3-man crew. Yeah. What are the 3 positions on that crew? What position did you occupy? And how do you guys work together to make those missions successful?
I stood at what we call the helm. It's about 3/4 of the way back on the left side. And you have the wheel and the power and everything.
So you're the coxswain.
Yeah, I'm the coxswain. And then right across between us is this big engine, but it's covered over with the wood. And then he's there, and his job is not only tend the engine, and if we get into waves, make sure that bilge pumps are working. And he lowers the ramp and brings it up. I'm the only one that's looking over the ramp up front. The reason why they had that ramp up front, originally the first boats, the soldiers had to go off the side and roll over the side and go off, and that didn't work. This way, the ramp, as wide as the boat was, heavy steel, was the only protection we had. And he would hit that lever, and it would fall down, making a runway. And they were designed, we could have carried, without troops, we could have carried a Jeep, say, or something like that. And our purpose was to get into the beach and hit the beach as hard as we could hit it. And the instant we hit, why the ramp came down. And the troops ran out right away because the enemy could fire right directly into it. If they hadn't knocked out the bunkers and everything else there, why, we had a murderous fire. Some invasions, we didn't have anything. And then my job right away, when the ramp went down, I started sticking it in reverse and waiting for that big engine to run, because it takes a half a second or two for those troops to get out of there. They're going out fast. And I'm waiting for that big engine to rev up. And then I'm watching all sides. and I see the water. It acts like, as with the width of the boat, the water curls in as it backs out. So I'm watching that, and I'm watching for cross current right away, and we try back straight out. We don't know, depending on the amount of boats, there may be a wave right behind us, but we'll be out clear when we get out beyond the breakers and all that, and it's more calm. We could swing the boat around and head back to the ship for our next load.
You know, I think a lot of people think, well, the guys who are in harm's way are these Marines who are racing off of the boat and trying to get ashore and find cover and not get shot while they're doing it. But you were in some pretty heavy danger there, too. How often did you get shot at, and what would you say was your closest call in a situation like that?
Well, the closest call, I had about six of them. But I was lucky in the sense that it was just a glancing blow on my steel helmet. And so they gave me a new helmet. And that was the closest I come to it. The other thing, the waves would batter the boat around, and they would. I had several cases of broken ribs. When we went over the equator, well, I had some busted ribs, so I didn't get to be initiated into the initiation when they go over the equator. But I did get their certificates and all that. And that, so a lot of the ships did not go over the equator, but we did. Anahuetok was an island out there, sand, and we seemed to end up there. And we would get no liberty or anything, but the sea was such that you'd look down, the water's just as clear as everything. And we'd get our fuel, our ammunition, and refrigeration. Lots of times we didn't get the troops on time, and so we become used to weevils in the bread and all that type of thing. But the GIs thought it was great food, and we thought it was terrible. But the boat crews are separate. Sometimes there's only... I remember passing out once when I asked the boatswain mate, I said, where are all the boats? And my nickname was Bud, and he said, Bud, that's it. And normally there's four boats across from us on the ship, and they were gone. And I understand boat 24, mine, and number 17 were the only two that came back out of the 24.
What does that do to you emotionally when you realize that, when you know that that could have been you and guys who were doing the same thing, guys that you trained with, weren't coming back?
I developed an attitude of kill or be killed. Because sometimes the beach commander or control boat would wave us off and it'd be night. We learned what those knives were for. The frogmen, the enemy frogmen, would swim out. And if they could catch a boat crew asleep, with just sitting way out there, they'd get on there and they would kill them. But you'd hear a scream in the night, a horrible scream that even today I can hear. And without saying a word, the motor mech would pull a 30 caliber and make sure there's a belt, and he'd stand on the little decking. And I would start up the engine and make a circle. And when we came by, about 12 feet out, he would spray the landing barge, knowing that we're killing our own kind, but we're killing the frogmen. And we know we can't board them, and they're screaming. And then the silence comes. You can cry, but you don't have time to cry. Once in a while, I'd get a cigar, and the motor mech would say, if I see tears coming down your left eye, I know we're in for trouble. Or if you bite that cigar in two, I know we're in trouble. And then he says, he yells to the troops. Of course, they have their own officers. He'd tell them to fix bayonets, load and lock and fix bayonets, because he knew we were going to be fighting right on the beach. In the Philippines, there was an LST that when they come in, they drop an anchor, and when they get to the beach, they pull that anchor line back, and it pulls them off the beach. But the trees were right down to the water. So we had to go in there about where the breakers were forming and spray the trees, the palm trees, killing the snipers so that they could get divers and get that untied. And that was pretty much shocking. And we learned when we'd hear a trinkle at night, if we were waved off the beach, we knew what it was. So we'd be sitting there and trying to get under where we thought they were coming. And then the idea was to get them in the belly with that knife. So we did learn what it was for.
Did you ever have to use it?
Oh, yes. Used it a lot. I remember going into a little island in New Guinea, and we lost our screw. And so us three jumped out. We'd never handled a bayonet in our life, but we picked up the bayonets, and the enemy was right there. I think some of the guys froze. We didn't. And when we got done at that place, that fight, we were in shock. Sticking that in and out, and you just do it automatically, and the strength you have is beyond reasoning. Oh, man. And so someone came up, a GI, I don't know if it was an officer or what, and he said, "Where'd you guys take your bayonet training?" And right away, I said, "We took it right here. We passed the course because we're alive." I just said it. And it's blood. You know, I mean, it's wrong. And it took us days to do over that. The chaplain used to say that when we were at sea, a lot of the landing craft crews would be standing at the dock, at the deck, looking out over the ocean, just looking there. And there's just times we just didn't talk. And we learned right away we didn't want to know the replacements. Because if you get friends with them and lose them, what's haunted me is that when we was going into Okinawa in the dark, as I was going to the landing barge, some guy in the landing craft, can't even describe what he looked like, he said, I walked in there and this sailor said, with a steel helmet, he says, "You know, I'm scared." And I said, "Well, I'll meet you here after it's all over." Well, after the hurricane and all that in Okinawa, he wasn't there. And that bothered me to this day.
I can tell it still bothers you. And those emotions are still very powerful. The memories are still clear. And there's more to come. He just talked about a hurricane. Mother Nature would pose quite a challenge, as would kamikazes. And we're going to get some of those stories from Bud Bedford, an LCVP coxswain during World War II in the Pacific. This is Hometown Heroes on News Talk 580 KMJ.
This is Hometown Heroes, honoring everyday Americans who answer the call of duty on 580 KMJ.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes. My guest today, Bud Bedford of Fresno. He'll turn 85 in just a little while. In fact, next month he'll do that. He's also participated in a new program at Fresno State, recording oral histories and archiving there on the campus. You'll hear more about that in upcoming editions of Hometown Heroes, but a great program that has been undertaken there. And Bud Bedford, before the break, told us about some of the invasions that he landed troops in. You heard him talk about Okinawa. We're going to hear some more stories now. And I want to hear about your run-ins with kamikaze pilots. Now, when you're not landing troops in LCVPs, you're actually aboard the ship, the USS Lycoming, APA 155. What kind of duties did you have on that ship, and how was it that you came to fire at a kamikaze?
Well, on the ship, we all stood gun watches, relieving the ship's crew from the gun watch. I was on a quad gun, sitting there as a gunner. And they have a crew that puts the ammunition in as we turn. The watches can get pretty dull, but that evening, The moon was out, and we were bored, and all of a sudden, the three guys that were loaders didn't say a word. They jumped out of the tub, and I saw something black coming, and it looked like it was skimming on the water. And I just pulled the trigger, started firing right away, and evidently another one did.
Another gun on another ship?
No, another gun towards the stern. So there's two quads firing. I saw a huge explosion out there. It seemed like it stopped for a second and then just blew apart. And that was that plane coming. And the other one did the same. And we sat there, quit shooting, of course, sat there, and I was stunned. I just couldn't even talk. It happened so quick. As I was sitting there, an officer came up and said, "You saved us, you guys." He said, "This would have gone into our desalting plant, which has boilers and the crew's quarters. And the other ones, they would have hit the powder magazine, and that would have been all it wrote."
So if those kamikazes had been successful in crashing into your ship, the ship probably would have sunk.
Oh, yes, we'd have blown up. The whole powder magazine would have went. In the Philippines, it seemed like the Japanese, and we spent a lot of time in the Philippines and the invasion and the Gulf of Leyte. We went in there, and as I understand it afterwards, they thought that the Japanese had moved out most of their troops in Leyte, but they hadn't. And so we ended up with a huge fight with 6,000, we had 6,000 Marines. And we were getting it on both sides because we didn't have a lot. The Navy was out further fighting the deadly battle at that time, and we didn't know that. And then we were really getting it from all sides, and there was obstructions put in the water, and a few of the boats got hung up on those, tore the bottoms out and that. And after that, holy heck, was done, and we realized in the reports we saw that they had buried 24,000 Japanese soldiers. So that became a major skirmish, which they only thought was going to be a minor. But we didn't lose that many. There was only about 800-900 Marines we lost. We lost a few landing barges, because we were shuttling ammunition and Red Cross supplies from here or there. But it wasn't too bad in that invasion. We were there when MacArthur walked ashore, but we didn't go ashore. Manila had so many ships sunk in the harbor, we never did get in, never even tried to get in.
Well, I know you faced many dangers in the war, from enemy fire to kamikazes, and Mother Nature was also a pretty major enemy at one point. Now, what about the typhoon? Now, you weren't on a Higgins boat during the typhoon. You were on the Lycoming, right?
No, the ship left early, and all the boats were left there. It turned black. Black as the ace of spades. The sea was rough. You was going up and down, and you couldn't tell anything. I don't think we could see 20 feet, 10 feet. So what I did was, this is it. Your time is here. So I said to the guys, I said, "We're going to sit here, and as funny as it sounds, we're not going to get scared. This is up to God. He is the master, because the amount of boats turning over, it's in the Lord's hands." And for some reason, we did. We sat there and weren't afraid. And it seemed like it was just endless. I looked over the side just one time, and I saw sand below us. And I don't know why, it just glowed to me. And I knew we was going to hit it, but we didn't. And you just had no control over it all. So the next morning, with all these ships, these boats, tugs over, laying over, landing barges upside down, and all that debris there. All I could do to the chaplain when I went back to the ship was I just told him that. This is what I'm saying here. It's up to God. And we did have things that I remember. I used to go to church with my mother, but I wasn't that religious. But I'll tell you, there are times when I didn't know I knew the Bible that good. And I don't know, we get an attitude of coldness. And the other thing that bothered me at first was to see about, say you brought in the second or third load, and the water between 4 and 5 feet out would be red with our blood. That would get me. And then the other thing that would get me is there'd be a body floating there, and I knew I was going to hit it, but you have to go ahead. And that's another feeling, that you're forcing your body and your actions to do what your mind is saying don't. It may be alive. Maybe that. We took a lot of the wounded out to the hospital ship, Hope, and the big hospital. I remember there was a bunch of surf, and the waves were high. And I looked down, and the guys on stretchers were worried. And I yelled real loud. I said, "Fellas, don't worry. We've been through this before. I'm going to get you out." And we did. We got out. And as we were going towards the hospital ship, we had a red flag up telling we had wounded. And then we put up a second one because we had wounded that was too far, too bad. So as we were going along, this one guy right below me, because I could look down right in front of me, the wheel and all that's in front, he was smiling for a while. And then all of a sudden, as we got close to the hospital ship, he died. His eyes were staring at me, and he was dead. And that hurt me. So, war, you can care, but you do what you have to do. I thought I'd get over it. I got in business and got busy and everything, but when I retired, it's all coming back slowly of all this. We are the greatest soldiers, the greatest servicemen in the world. I would forget that I was young and look out at those load of troops, and their faces would look so young. And everyone, look at them, and they're the greatest in the world. They fight, they think, and everything, because you can go through all the instructions you want. But it's that GIs or whatever it is in the service that has the ability to think on a basis and have that leadership. They all do.
Well, and you've really shed some light for us today, I think, on the mindset of a soldier in World War II, of the emotional burden that the whole thing became and still remains all these years later. I want to ask you, Bud, and I know that you were on schedule to participate in the invasion of mainland Japan, and the atomic bombs probably saved your life. You got to come home. So many did not. More than 400,000 Americans were killed during World War II. What was it like for you when you arrived back in the United States after the war? After everything you had been through, everything you survived, all the nights where you didn't think you were going to wake up the next day, to see the United States of America again, what did that mean to you?
Well, we pulled into San Francisco with a load of troops that was happy the war was over. We unloaded, and then the ship started out, and we were on the ship. And just then, as we were going out, they called my name and several more and said, "If you can get in the pilot boat, you're civilians." So, man, I ran with my work clothes on and got that picket or packet of stuff and went down. They shipped us down to Long Beach right away, but they had to put us in some type of a uniform, which they weren't too happy. When I got down there, the medic said, your stomach has shrunk, and we'd like to have you stay in for another 3 or 4 days. Get your stomach functioning. And I said, no, I am inactive reserve now. It was sad. My dad had died. My mother had sold the ranch, which I wanted. And she was standing beside the car, and I walked out the gate, and there was my mother. So it was not a happy reunion. And then we went home. But we came out of that, and then I eventually got my own business and went on from there. But it's hard. There's so much that goes on each day in war. It's hard to talk about it. And so that's why I have a respect for every GI. I hope people realize what our Army and Navy and Air Force are, and show them respect, because they sure deserve it, and their families suffer too. War is terrible, beyond words.
Well, I know it takes a lot of courage to talk about these very emotional issues, and I appreciate your doing that. Thank you for serving our country and for telling us a little about it. Thanks to Bud Bedford of Fresno for being my guest today. Thanks for listening on News Talk 580 KMJ.